From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
It's back to the economy. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Bill Clinton made It's the Economy Stupid, a rule of American politics. Now Barack Obama says Washington has largely taken its eye off the ball. Nobody disagrees, but Republicans were trashing the president's latest pivot to jobs in the middle class even before today's major speech was delivered. We'll hear what Mr. Obama has to say as he kicks off another public relations campaign. What about job growth, stimulus spending, and the sequester? With Republicans promising that his priorities are going nowhere, can he avoid another collision that could shut down the government in October? Today's talking point, ranking the insiders in Washington, D.C. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. After months of debate about gun control, immigration, and government spying, President Obama has begun an effort to turn Washington's attention back to the economy. We heard about today's first speech in a new public relations campaign as Republicans take aim at all his priorities, both new and old. Today's talking point, Washington, D.C., is being called a gilded capital where politicians and media figures form a celebrity culture that influences national policy. We'll talk with the author of a new book on insiders called This Town. First, this news update. In light of Egypt's military takeover, President Obama is delaying the sale of four F-16 fighter jets to that country. Today in Cairo, the commanding general, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, called for massive demonstrations on Friday to give him a mandate to crack down on violence and terrorism. Karim Fahim reports from Cairo for the New York Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Are violence and terrorism code words for something else?
A lot of people see it that way. I mean, a lot of people listening to the commander's speech today believe that he was talking directly to supporters of Mohamed Morsi, the president, who was deposed by the military on July 3rd. And so this is seen as stepping up what's been an ongoing confrontation between Mr. Morsi supporters, who have been in the streets since his ouster, and opponents of the former president, including the military and the police force.
Tell us about the circumstances of the speech as he stood with his sunglasses on, all of his medals and ribbons on his chest, addressing military graduates.
It was a striking image for a number of reasons. I mean, it was an unusual speech for a defense minister to make under any circumstances. And in particular now, we're in the middle of this very delicate transition with thousands of people sort of continually protesting. And the army, which played this central role in deposing the former president, has tried to assure people that it's not seeking to play any political role, and it introduced this roadmap for the transition that was going to quickly lead to elections and to a return to civilian rule. And the sort of picture we saw today suggested something very different. A general calling on Egyptians to take to the streets, essentially to support further action by him and his military. So people are still to grips with what it means.
There are those who are putting on television split images with General Sisi on the one hand and Muammar Gaddafi on the other, the suggestion being that perhaps he's planning to take over as Egypt's leader, if not already proclaiming himself the de facto leader.
Well, certainly the Muslim Brotherhood, the movement that Mr. Morsi comes from, is trying to make those comparisons. And from the beginning, it's been calling the military action a coup against the legitimacy of the of Egypt's first freely elected president. And so they have been highlighting the sort of martial nature of the transition so far. But even among the military supporters, you know, there has been sort of murmurs about some future political role for General Sisi. He has become very, very popular here since he deposed Mr. Morsi. His picture seems to hang more places than Mr. Morsi's ever did, including in government buildings, which is unusual. The military has courted the public vigorously since Mr. Morsi was deposed, with air shows. And so I think the talk of a future role for him can't easily be dismissed.
Have we heard from any of the people likely to be civilian leaders endorsed by the military sometime soon?
There's an interim government that started operating last week and has started the process of rewriting the Constitution. And today we saw them on TV at what was supposed to be the first meeting of a national reconciliation effort. But everything they do at this point is completely overshadowed by the sort of main feud here between the Brotherhood and the military. And General Sisi didn't do anything to help the perception that the civilian government, as a lot of people say, look like a sort of a puppet effort at this point. Some of the civilian leaders talk about the violence, which seems to be intensifying here, but it's not very clear that they have any authority over anything. Today we seem to get a greater sense who is sort of calling the shots in Egypt.
So with the general then calling for demonstrations on Friday, everybody must be bracing for that. We will as well. Farim Fahim in Cairo for The New York Times. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks again.
In a moment, it's back to the economy on To the Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. For today's major economic address, President Obama returned to Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, where as a U.S. senator in 2005, he made his first speech as a national figure. Today's talk was the kickoff for a new public relations campaign.
So good jobs, a better bargain for the middle class and the folks who are working to get into the middle class. An economy that grows from the middle out, not the top down. That's where I will focus my energies.
And the president said that over the next several weeks, he'll cross the country to lay out plans for helping Americans work their way into the middle class.
I'll lay out my ideas for how we build on the cornerstones of what it means to be middle class in America and what it takes to work your way into the middle class in America. Job security with good wages and durable industries. A good education. A home to call your own. Affordable health care when you get sick. A secure retirement even if you're not rich. Reducing poverty, reducing inequality, growing opportunity. That's what we need.
Jim Tankersley is economic policy correspondent for The Washington Post. And Jim, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren. And thanks for using all blues to bring me in. It seems appropriate with the economy this way.
Perhaps it does. So the president tried to indicate that the economy is in better shape than a lot of people think it is today. But he also said, of course, as he so often has, that it's not good enough. What does he mean by growing from the middle out? How important is that?
Well, growing from the middle out is a way of thinking about longer-term economic growth in a way that it flows from the middle class and in which the middle class is not the product of giving money to people at the top. I guess the easiest way to think about it would be the idea that your economy is just going to do better. It's going to be more stable. It's going to have more prosperity for more people, and it's going to be, in general, a better growing economy if you have a strong middle class or a strengthening middle class compared to the stagnating one we've seen for the last couple of decades.
So is this in contrast, then, to trickle down?
Yeah, trickle down would be, this is sort of the direct response to trickle down, which is the idea that if you give a lot of money to people at the top, it will make its way to the people in the middle and at the bottom and improve them by virtue of the people at the top creating jobs and spending the money.
How does this work out then in terms of specific proposals as the president begins to lay them out? He says he'll do more of that in the future.
Well, the president has a couple of familiar short-term proposals, for example, infrastructure spending to try to get a little more growth in the economy. But most of this is longer term. He's talking about things like investing in universal preschool, which would help the educational prospects of poorer and middle-class children, help them compete and do better in college, talking about college affordability. But those are more longer-term structural fixes to the idea that we just don't have enough skills in our economy right now.
What chance does he have of getting these programs passed by the Congress?
I think it's hard to say that the president has a chance of getting anything passed right now. I hear that a lot from people when I write about the shortfall so far in the president's progress towards his own goals. I do think there are a few areas where he probably will be able to work with Republicans as part of a longer-term budget deal. He might be able to get a little more spending for these manufacturing research centers that he wants to do and the like. But overall, this is more of an aspirational speech than it is laying out a pathway to compromise.
He has been sidetracked on so many issues, gun safety and immigration, and of course, there's the National Security Agency, and government spying has been a big a subject. Is he trying to just change the subject?
No, I mean, I don't think he's trying to change the subject when he's getting back to the thing that Americans care most about time and time again in opinion polling. I think maybe what you've seen is that over the last 6 months, and the president says Washington as if it's everyone but him, but it includes him. Washington just hasn't been that focused on the plight of regular people in the economy, particularly unemployed people. And there's some reasons for that. One of the big ones is the stock market's been doing great, and rich people have been happy, and polls show that they've been happier, which probably means they're pressuring members of Congress less to do more about the economy.
Okay, we're talking with Jim Tankersley again, the economic policy correspondent for the Washington Post. The president was scathing about Republicans in Congress, saying they refused to pay the bills they'd rung up and left in place the sequester that he said has cost jobs, economic growth, hurt the military, gutted investments in education and medical research as well.
And if you ask some of these folks, mostly in the House, about their economic agenda, how it is that they'll strengthen the middle class, they'll shift the topic to out-of-control government spending, despite the fact that we've cut the deficit by nearly half as a share of the economy since I took office.
Gerald Seib is Washington bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal, author of the Capital Journal column. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Let's pick up where we just left off with Jim Tankersley. How are the Republicans responding to this?
Well, I think they're responding by essentially saying, same old stuff, let's get down to cutting spending. And in fact, you know, that's sort of interesting because that's the exact point the president's trying to make today here, which is that's the paradigm we need to break out of. We've been sort of stuck in this debate throughout the economic crisis that started in 2007 of whether the government should be engaged in stimulus spending or fiscal austerity. And we got to get beyond that if we're going to be competitive for the next 10 or 20 years. So that's the debate he doesn't want to have, and he's trying to set up a fall in autumn in which there'll be a debt ceiling decision to be made in Washington. Do we raise the debt ceiling or not? And a bunch of decisions on spending and trying to get people to look beyond that short-term arithmetic.
What about the sequester, which we heard him denounce today, and the whole idea of austerity? Where do the Republicans come down on that?
Well, I think that the Republicans in the House, at least, are trying to essentially lock in sequester-level spending, and not necessarily in the exact ways the sequester put the cuts into place. They want, for example, to shift some money into defense and out of domestic programs. But they like the idea that the sequester held down the domestic spending. They want to lock that stuff in. The president is essentially saying today that's kind of a silly way to cut spending. Don't use an axe, use a scalpel, to, you know, to use the terminology that he employed. What he didn't say, but I'm sure is true, is that they think that sequester cuts on the domestic side went way too deep and some of those need to be rectified.
Just quickly, I want to hear from the majority leader, Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who had a very brief response, at which we're just about to hear.
What's the point? What's it going to accomplish? Probably got the answer. Nothing. It's a hollow shell. It's an Easter egg with no candy in it.
Heidi Shierholz is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute, progressive think tank in Washington. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What's your take on austerity and the sequester and the idea that the Republicans are expressing, which is that, you know, more spending and the kinds of priorities that the president has elucidated today, gone back to, as Jim Tankersley said, really aren't doing anything?
Yeah, the intellectual case, the academic case for austerity has been overwhelmingly denounced. There's overwhelming evidence that austerity has large negative impacts in a slump. So that's what we're up against, this kind of Obama talking about how we need to not do these big meat cleaver style cuts at a time when the economy is really depressed. We actually need to be stimulating economic activity, which will generate jobs, rather than going in the opposite direction, which we know will prolong the slump. Doing these cuts, pulling this economic activity out of the economy, will actually make the recovery weaker and make it a longer slog to real health in the labor market, which is the thing that he was really trying to talk about here. He wants to reach the people who are the most affected by this downturn, and what we need now is not additional government austerity that will pull economic activity out of the economy and cost jobs.
We'll have a conservative response to that in a few moments. But what about what Jim Tankersley suggested earlier, Heidi Shierholz, that the president is as much responsible for Washington turning away from the economy and what people really care about as the Republicans?
Yeah, there's something there. The pivot to the concern about deficits was way too soon, way too fast, and the administration actually helped in that. You know, the Obama administration actually, you know, you heard Obama saying things very early on in the recovery that, you know, Americans are tightening their belt, the government needs to do that too. And that's actually completely wrong. At a time when everyone else has stopped spending, that's the exact time where the government steps in and actually sustains economic activity. So it's actually the opposite. And I from what he said on many occasions, so I actually really wish he would have helped educate the public on macroeconomics, that at a time when no one else is spending, that's when the government needs to not just not tighten their belts. That's when they need to really step in with boosting the economy.
So, Jim Tankersley, back to you with the Washington Post. Has the president hurt his own case? Did he do so to some extent today in the speech?
Well, I mean, first off, I would like to say that I applaud Heidi for asking the president to teach the country macroeconomics. But I think that what the president was trying to do today in the speech was pretty clear. He's trying to make a case for this budget battle coming in the fall. And you can see that from the Twitter hashtag, a better bargain, that the White House used in tweeting about the speech. They are trying to make the case that the cuts that Republicans are going to be pushing for or the spending reductions that they're going to try to lock in hurt the middle class. And so this is really about, I think, positioning for those battles in the fall.
Gerald Seib, back to you with the Wall Street Journal. How far have the Republicans gone in saying that they want not only to see the sequester stay in effect, but also make more cuts, even to the point where there's been some mumbling about the possibility that the government might have to shut down?
Well, look, right now, if you look at the appropriations bills that the Senate on the one side and the House on the other are considering just for domestic programs, there's about a $90 billion difference between what Democrats in the Senate are proposing to spend and what Republicans in the House are proposing to spend. That's a pretty big gap, and it's not just the aggregate number, it's some of the ways in which that money would be spent. Now, there are Republicans, and then there are Republicans in the House, and then there are Republicans in the Senate, and I think there's probably lots more room for Democrats and Republicans to compromise on spending in the Senate than there might be in the House. I think the real question is how much of that debate, which is a pure spending debate, gets tangled up with the question of whether to raise the debt ceiling. Some Republicans don't want to go there. They just want to have they want to stay away from the debt ceiling this time, have the conversation about how much spending we can really afford on its own merits, and others want to intertwine the two. And that, I think, is going to be the big question of the fall. Does the debt ceiling get resolved separate from the spending fight, or does it become part of the spending fight?
What about what the president is doing now, Gerald Seib, saying that he's going to be touring the country, whether he's educating the public about macroeconomics or simply trying to make a case? Is it going to be effective? He's very good at campaigning, we know that, and he's won a couple of elections.
Well, I don't know how effective it will be, in the sense that I don't know that he can go give speeches around the country and generate some movement in Congress to magically pass things that he put in his budget back in February that have gone nowhere. I think what he can do, and I think the real goal here, is to change the conversation, to compel a conversation that's not just about short-term spending and debt decisions, but that's about, you know, how much should the government be investing in research? What sort of infrastructure projects ought to be paid for now? How do you do education reform? Should there be corporate tax code changes? I mean, to get beyond the kind of the green eye shade aspect of the budget and talk about some of these other things, I'm not sure, again, how much that can be successful, except it does kind of compel Republicans to address some things other than just spending and debt. And, you know, if that's what happens here, it's probably a minor victory for the president, but it may be a waste of breath, frankly. You just can't tell.
Jim Tankersley, back to you. Elaborate a bit, if you will, on how the middle class is hurting. That's a major point that the president wants to make as he moves into this middle-out approach to the economy. How bad is it?
It's bad, and it's gotten worse since the recovery ended, which is something that the president alluded to a little bit, but you know, obviously, didn't want to dwell on. Median income for American families, when you adjust for inflation, is about the same as today as it was in 1989. I mean, that's a long time of no movement forward, and it's actually about 4% lower than it was at the end of the recession. So, with a lot of tough things happening in the labor market still, without any real upward pressure on wages, what we're seeing is a middle class that is sort of staying in place while a lot of income gains, all the income gains and wealth gains from the recovery so far, have flowed to people near the very top of the distribution.
Heidi Shierholz, the president, talked today about income inequality.
Yeah, it was nice to hear him really talk about how that, you know, income inequality is a real problem for the economy, and we should address it head on. That when you don't have a strong middle class, when you have income just going to the top of the, you know, going to the already affluent, which is what Jim was just talking about, you really have just decimated your consumption base. And that really hurts the economy going forward. So it was nice to hear him talking about that. I wish he would have, you know, talked more about really the solutions to you know, more directly about what we need to do to lead to broadly shared prosperity rather than this rising income inequality. But it's really nice that he's, you know, bringing this concern to the fore and talking about how it's a real drag on our economy.
Okay. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll talk with our current guests and also have Doug Holtz-Aiken, who is with the American Action Forum, conservative organization, on Reporter's Notebook, or excuse me, on Talking Point later. We'll be ranking insiders in this town, or talking about how that is done, America's gilded capital, where all of our guests actually live. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Warman Ollie back with To The Point. Once again, President Obama has begun a nationwide public relations effort to promote an economic agenda directed at the middle class. Here's more of what he had to say today.
I will not allow gridlock or inaction or willful indifference to get in our way. That means whatever executive authority I have to help the middle class, I'll use it.
President, once again speaking at Kent College in Galesburg, Illinois. Doug Holtz-Eakin was director of the Congressional Budget Office. He was an advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign. He's now president of the American Action Forum. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
We heard earlier in our program that what the president is doing is, with his middle-out approach to the economy, is responding directly to the idea of a trickle-down and trying to build from the middle class, create a consuming a class that will more directly inject money into the economy. And, of course, he also wants more government spending. How do you think well, we've also heard that Republicans are going to respond to that, or have already responded, as saying it doesn't do anything. What do you anticipate for the near future?
I don't anticipate a lot. I mean, I thought this was a very long and repetitive speech. We've heard 99% of this before. You know, he can label it middle out. He can contrast it with trickle down. He can say a lot of things. But in the end, there's a set of policies that he has enacted, a set of policies that have delivered the economy that we've got, and it's not very good. So I think, you know, you can't change that. I think he wants to frame a debate going into the fall with the end of the year and the funding for the government and the debt limit debate coming up. I think that's sensible strategy. He should do that. I would if I were him. But I don't think he moved the needle at all on the fundamental problems facing the economy.
And how best can those fundamental problems, in your opinion, and those of the Republicans, be resolved?
Oh, I think that we need some deep structural reforms in five areas, and we're not getting them. We need entitlement reform. Those are social safety net programs that are financially endangered. They feed the big deficits and big debt that we have, and we need to fix that. We need a tax reform so that we have a tax code that raises money, pays for the government, does it in a way that doesn't impede growth and competitiveness. We certainly need immigration reform, and it's the one place we've seen some progress. I remain hopeful we'll get that over the finish line. We need some education reforms. Again, a place the president has talked a lot, and I believe in the K-12 area has said many of exactly the right things, but that's not gotten over the finish line really yet. And we need some regulatory reform, where I think the president's gone the wrong direction. We now have an increasingly burdensome regulatory strait. If we do those five things, we set ourselves up well for the 21st century.
Do we need more austerity?
We've never needed austerity. We need reforms. I thought one of the most disappointing parts of the speech was his discussion of the sequester. And, you know, frankly, he attempts to rewrite history all the time and gives speeches as if he wasn't in Washington when he's the president, has been for over a term. He authored the idea of the sequester. He signed it into law. He said he wanted more taxes as a way to not do this. He got the taxes. We still have it. And he's never advanced any other spending program reforms to replace it. And here we have a bad policy, and it's staying that way.
Doug Holtz-Eakin, American Action Forum, on the conservative side of the spectrum. Heidi Shierholz, back to you, economist with the Economic Policy Institute, a progressive think tank in Washington. How do you respond to what we just heard?
Well, I'm happy to hear Doug talk about how we never needed austerity. That's exactly right. The real problem right now, the big crisis facing us right now, is the lack of jobs in the economy. We have a lack of demand for work to be done. Corporations are sitting on cash, not because, I don't actually think it's because they're being greedy. I think it's because they're smart. They're not going to hire people until they see demand for their goods and services pick up in a way where they need to hire people. That's just the bottom line. They're just not seeing that yet. So we need more spending in the economy. So I know Doug talked about how we don't need austerity. We actually should be going in the other direction. So the things that Obama laid out, like infrastructure spending, shoring, taking this opportunity when interest rates are really low, it's really cheap to invest, to shore up our degraded infrastructure. It's exactly the right kind of thing we would be doing. And I just don't necessarily think that those reforms that Doug laid out will actually be job generators. You know, entitlement reform, that's a way to say cuts in Medicare and Social Security. Those are hugely popular programs. I don't think that's what the American people want. The bottom line right now is we need to get jobs back, and then we need to focus on things that will reverse the rising inequality that we saw for the three decades before the Great Recession. So that would, I mean, Obama talked about how the decline in unionization was a contributor to the increasing inequality, but he didn't talk about anything we could do to reverse that, you know, talking about reforms that we could do to make sure that labor law can catch up to increased employer aggressiveness in fighting union drives that we've seen in the last 30 years would be a good place to start.
Doug Holtz-Eakin, back to you. What about more spending? Something the president obviously wants. Heidi Shierholz says that's the only way to begin improving the economy, get more money into it, and then you can worry about the other issues.
There's a very straightforward playbook for countries in our position with bad growth and big debts, and that is to do tax reforms which support growth. We've done tax increases instead, and to preserve core functions of government, which would in our case be national security, basic research, education, infrastructure, the kinds of things that are in the annual discretionary accounts, and control the spending on the transfer side of the program. And that for us, that would be a sustainable Social Security program, a sustainable Medicare program, a sustainable Medicaid program, none of which we have. We're doing it exactly backwards. And so I have lots of sympathy for the notion that we ought to have much better discretionary spending programs and take infrastructure. But what's missing in this conversation is the idea that it can't just be more. We have 100 federal transportation programs, not one of which has a clear objective. We ought to have about 4, and they ought to be centered around the notion that we should have national connectivity that supports economic growth, that we get cargo from ports to trains to tractor-trailer trucks. There's never any discussion of reforming those programs to spend the money well, and there's never a discussion of the flip side, which is, you know, we can't do everything and more of everything. So how are we going to make this add up? And that the fact that the entitlement programs have been off limits has just paralyzed the debate.
Heidi Shierholz, how do you respond to that, particularly with regard to trying to fine-tune spending programs? If we have 100 federal programs that don't seem to be well-organized, should we reduce them? And would that be a good way to go, be more efficient, more targeted in spending?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of things that we could do making those programs more streamlined. That's one of the reasons why the sequester, the across-the-board cuts are a problem. We need to go at this in a really mindful, thoughtful way to be smarter about our government spending. One of the things that I think is really important to note is that Social Security is not one of the entitlement programs that is contributing to any of our long-run deficit problems. The Social Security trustees report just recently came out. It is we can fully pay out the current level of benefits for the next 20 years with no changes to the program. We do not need to make any changes to Social Security to fully pay out benefits for the next 20 years. And even after that, if we don't make any changes, we could still pay out about 80% of the benefits. So with small fixes to Social Security, like removing the cap on earnings, if you earn over $110,000, you don't pay Social Security taxes on that money over $110,000. Small fixes like removing that cap can close that Social Security gap so that it is actually fully funded for the full time horizon. They always look out 75 years to see if it works. With small fixes, we can fully fund that 75 years out.
Doug Holtz-Eakin, what about reversing the inequality of income and wealth distribution?
One of the hardest problems that I think we face. certainly, if you look at the broad trends, it's clear what has happened. We've had a massive global influx of relatively low-skilled labor, which is now becoming increasingly higher-skilled in places like India and China. That absolutely battered the return to low-skilled labor, and that's true in the U.S. and elsewhere. To go with that labor, you need capital, and the return to financial capital went way up. If you look at the mechanically what's all true in the United States, we had too many unskilled, low-wage workers who don't have any financial capital, so they really got hit at both ends. People who had skills and cash did real well. So the obvious way to reverse that is to fix the education system so that people graduate from high school capable of going on if they want, moving into a skilled trade if they don't, and we don't have a system that does that. It's 12 years after the passage of No Child Left Behind. We've documented the failures, but we haven't fixed it. That's got to be number one. That'll fix things, but slowly. And, you know, patience is not an American virtue. So I don't expect that to be a miracle cure. It'd also be a very good idea to think hard about a secure retirement savings system. We have a Social Security system that's in more danger, I think, than my counterpart does. We can have that debate. But even if it's in great shape, it's not enough. The benefits are really minimal for a lot of people, and we don't have a good comprehensive private pension system, individual savings bad. Those are places to concentrate.
Let us go back to where we began, in Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, where the president talked to a very enthusiastic college crowd.
I do not intend to wait until the next campaign or the next president before tackling the issues that matter. I care about one thing and one thing only, and that's how to use every minute The only thing I care about is how to use every minute of the remaining 1,276 days of my term to make this country work for working Americans again.
Doug Holtzeken, back to you. The president says he's run his last campaign, but it would appear he is embarking on one more.
Yes. Today was the kickoff.
Yeah, well, and he said that too. Do you anticipate that people will be listening? Will he be able to get attention, especially at this time of year, middle of the summer?
I wouldn't be too optimistic. I mean, we've seen the president do this before. The agenda starts getting controlled by events and not by the White House. His popularity suffers. They embark on a campaign-style initiative like this. It's better if there's something behind it. And to my eye, and looking through the speech, there's not a lot that's new here. People have heard these ideas. They either like them, dislike them, whatever you might think. They either become law or they haven't. So if you ask the question, what will this campaign do to policies and actual conditions on the ground, the answer is probably not much.
All right, Sherholtz, what do you think?
Yeah, I have that same concern. I think one of the issues that he's up against is there was a lot of sort of cheerleading in the speech about how far we've come, but that may not resonate with people on the ground who are still really hurting. This recovery is extremely weak, so he might not have actually reached those people to where they've recognized their experience in what he said. For most people, what we need is actually, we have to focus on this long run, but there's a real crisis going on right now. And so he might not have actually said things that resonated with the people who are really feeling it right now.
And Doug Holtzeken, is there a prospect of the government shutting down if the debates you talked about earlier aren't resolved in the early part of October?
We face two hurdles between now and the end of the year. The first is September 30th, when funding for this fiscal year ends, and there will have to be a bridge funding bill because neither the House nor the Senate has actually done its work and completed appropriation. So getting that worked out has never proven easy. I'm at least nervous about the prospects. The key facts are that we have spending commitments in law, the Budget Control Act that the president signed in August 2011. The Senate's about $50 billion above the law, and says that's what it wants to do. The House is at the right level, but they have more defense and less defense, non-defense, than the law says. So that looks to me like a train wreck with no particular guidance on any side in terms of how we're going to work it out, and I'm nervous about that. And then the debt limit increase has proven in recent years to just be a very problematic moment, because the debt limit does have to be increased. There's no question about that. But the tradition in American politics is you attach to a debt limit increase some commitment on us never to get so much debt again. Those commitments weren't a big deal when we didn't have a lot of debt. They've become very contentious now. So I'm worried about both.
Heidi Schulholz, we have 15 seconds left. Shut down the government? Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, the case for brinkmanship on that front has totally fallen. It's totally collapsed. If you want to push the debt limit because you think we have a debt crisis, we have declining debt projections right now. If you say slashing spending will boost the economy, there's now overwhelming evidence that austerity at a time like this actually causes negative impacts. So the case for Republicans doing that kind of brinkmanship has completely collapsed.
Okay.
I still think it might happen.
All right. Heidi Schulholz again, economist with the Economic Policy Institute. That's a progressive think tank in Washington. Doug Holtz-Eakin, formerly the director of the Congressional Budget Office, worked in Senator McCain's campaign for president. He's now president of the American Action Forum. Thank you both. Thanks to our other guests as well. Great to have you today as the president begins this new campaign. There is no index in Mark Leibovich's new book on Washington insiders, so those players wishing to know how do they come out are going to have to read the book. We'll hear how politicians and media figures have become celebrities and how that influences the making of national policy. The author of This Town in a moment on To the Point.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Aldie back with today's talking point on To the Point. We didn't anticipate that the president's speech today at Knox College would be sort of illustrative of some of the points that are made by our next speaker, but here it is.
With this endless parade of distractions and political posturing and phony scandals, Washington's taken its eye off the ball. And I'm here to say this needs to stop. This needs to stop.
Well, This Town is a book about Washington. It's subtitled Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. The author, Mark Leibovich, is chief national correspondent for The New York Times Magazine. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Warren.
Pick it up from where we heard the president drop it there. He was talking about public policy, but in a real way, it seems to me, that's what your book is about, too.
Yes, he's staying on message to the rollout for my book. No, I mean,
you spoke to him about this.
We had a great conversation this morning. Essentially, this is a book about how Washington, especially over the last 20 years, has been given over to certainly celebrity. Certainly, the new media revolution has affected this town maybe more than any other in the country, and also the power of wealth. I mean, the incredible flood of money into the Capitol has really fundamentally changed the ethic of people coming here to get into politics, which is, you know, used to be a city built on public service and has become one that's now largely given over to self-service. And I think part of this is trying to maybe initiate some of the distractions that the president was talking about.
You write pretty scathingly about the way the insiders relate to one another, or don't relate to one another.
Yeah.
When they feel. Describe a little bit the funeral that begins your book.
Yeah, the opening scene, and it's the prologue, and also the first chapter is the memorial service for Tim Russert, who's this beloved newsman and died in 2008. And I went to the Kennedy Center, which was like a state funeral. I mean, presidents were there, former presidents were there, senators, congressmen, the two nominees for that year's election, Barack Obama and John McCain, were there. I mean, it was just this incredibly star-studded occasion, and I was just struck by how the occasion was given over to networking in a cocktail party atmosphere, and everyone was sort of swarmed around the winners of the day, whether it was the Obama team or the McCain team, trying to get them booked on their shows and passing business cards around. And I sort of figured that at that point, Washington had reached a tipping point of self-celebration, and it was time to really chronicle the carnival over the next few years. So that's what I did.
With all due respect to the late Tim Russert, is it surprising to you, or was it at the time, or is it illustrative of what's been happening over the last few years, that a guy who was a television news person would, in fact, attract that kind of a crowd?
Yeah, I mean, Tim Russert was unique also, though, but he sort of lived very much in the nexus of politics, of media, of money. I mean, he was sort of the unofficial mayor of official Washington, right? And his death obviously left a void in the media, but I think also the pageantry around his death and really, frankly, the overcoverage of everything that went on after he died was, I think, again, very illustrative of how it has all about, it's become about the show. It is not about the substance of what brought people here.
What does that mean for policy?
Well, I mean, if you look at the current track record of the Congress and actually getting things done and passing bills, it doesn't bode very well. But I think the dirty little secret here is one, Washington is doing extremely well for itself. It has become the most economically successful area of the country. It's home to seven of the wealthiest top 10 counties in the country, the metropolitan area here. And it's all happened at a time when the rest of the country has, one, struggled economically, but also extremely disappointed with how it's, you know, theoretically its leaders are leading in D.C. So I think that's one of the many disconnects I explore, but also the level of self-celebration here and how it this is not merited and how it's sort of a perverse contrast to how the rest of the country sees Washington.
Self-celebration that is not merited. Give us some examples.
Well, the White House Correspondents' Dinner every spring. I mean, there is this huge banquet in which the national media and Hollywood and politicians and staffers and hangers-on just gather and toast themselves, and it's no longer sufficient to have a single banquet to celebrate the accomplishments of the Washington media. We must now have a five-day smorgasbord of pre-parties and after-parties, and it's really just become this perverse spectacle in which that is really a great symbol of the bubble world that people live in Washington and the complete lack of self-awareness and self-consciousness, or even worse, I mean, an awareness of how the excess has gotten out of control, but no willingness or no real desire to stop it.
You are careful not to exempt yourself from the culture that you write about. What kind of response have you gotten so far?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I come clean very early on. I mean, I live here. I choose to live here. I cover politics for a major news organization, and I have for some time. The response has been, I mean, a lot of people have asked me if this has been uncomfortable for me here as someone who sees these people around town. Maybe a little, but I think I sort of welcome the discomfort because I think this is a very, very comfortable time in the Washington media, and I think it's actually a very, very comfortable time in the Capitol. And I think that I mean, a lot of the criticism, if there has been any, and mostly the book's been very well received, but the criticism has sort of been of the how dare he vein, how dare someone who is a part of the club speak critically about others in the club. I mean, that sort of violates an unwritten code, if such a thing exists. So whatever, though, hasn't really bothered me.
The club has a certain connotation about it, and you go into the idea of calling it the club at some length.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of this unelected cabal of political people, sort of lifers, journalists, lobbyists. I mean, some are elected, actually. But it's just this sort of big, free-floating assembly of people who are they're sort of seeing each other, they're yelling at each other on TV, but ultimately they're a very interconnected and powerful colossus. It's what one Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, a very conservative Republican, calls the permanent feudal class of Washington, D.C., and that's essentially what it is. And I think that's one of the reasons this book has resonated, I think, a fair amount outside of the Beltway, and people on both sides have really kind of seen this as an object lesson of what the excesses of Washington have become and what they have looked like in the last few years.
What does it mean for journalism and what the rest of the country comes to learn from journalists about the national scene and the way policy is made and should be made if reporters and the people they cover are all part of the same club?
Well, I mean, I think it's not a new threat. I mean, there's always been a bubble in the media. I mean, Boys on the Bus, which was written in 1972, sort of talks about packed journalism. But I think what's happened now is just the growth of new media has just made this sprawling free-for-all of really sort of a Wild West in the peanut gallery, right? I mean, people, everyone sort of weighing in. And look, it gets to a point where fame itself becomes the end all. And my business, which is print journalism, and it's all I've ever done, and it's all I've ever wanted to do, has reached a point where punditry has become the gold standard as opposed to reporting, which is, you know, what we were talking when I was coming up. So, again, it rewards noise. It rewards outrageousness. It rewards anything that'll sort of get you page clicked, and I think that that's ultimately bad for the conversation.
You talked about the extraordinary wealth that has now been accumulated in Washington after World War II. It was kind of a tacky town, so that's happened over a long period of time.
You can still say it's a tacky town in some ways.
Tacky in different ways, maybe,
right.
With a lot of bling. But is that the reason, do you think, that people in general who are members of the club have taken their eyes off the ball when it comes to the economy and the condition of the rest of the country?
Between people around Washington and in Washington and the rest of the country has to be colored by economics, because by and large people around here or the people who are in these jobs are doing a lot better than the people they are theoretically talking to or governing. Or what have you. So I think that's a huge part of the disconnect. I also think that money, I mean, you sort of wonder, I mean, about 50% of all retiring senators and maybe 42% of all retiring congressmen now become lobbyists, and that was maybe 2-3% back in the 70s. So you sort of wonder, when so many people are staying here and so many people are going through the revolving door, you sort of have to wonder, when people are in office, what are they thinking about? Are they thinking about their next gig? Are they thinking about the payoff? Or are they thinking about the people who elected them there? So I think there are a lot of forces at work.
You say people who ask, how could he? Do you think that for people outside the Beltway, this is going to simply confirm their worst fears about the nation's capital? Are you looking for big sales beyond the Beltway?
I certainly wouldn't mind big sales. No, look, this book is aimed to people outside of the Beltway. I mean, this book has generated a lot of intrigue and a lot of speculation and a lot of who's up, who's down, and it's been pretty crazy around Washington, but I kind of expected that. But what's been my goal was to both educate, entertain, and just really shine a light on this culture for people who don't live here. And the response has been amazing. So I'm really happy, and hopefully it'll continue.
Mark Leibovich, the book is The Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.